Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with a move from Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton that has sent shockwaves across the nation's capital and the world. Congressman Moulton, a Democrat, and his colleague, Republican Congressman Peter Meyer of Michigan, traveled to Kabul on Tuesday to conduct oversight, quote unquote, of the ongoing evacuations. They are both veterans of the Iraq War. The trip came as President Biden continues to resist calls to extend the deadline to remove all American troops from Afghanistan. Biden said yesterday that the U.S. is still on pace to meet the current plan to complete the withdrawal by August 31st, 6 days from now. The Biden administration has expressed great displeasure over the congressman's unauthorized oversight expedition. Here to talk about the reverberations from Moulton's actions yesterday, David Gergen, former White House advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, and the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he also teaches. David, thanks for joining us.
Tiziana, good. Good to be with you again.
So, David, I'm mindful that Congressman Moulton belongs to us here in the Commonwealth. People are very angry with him. Some are. What was your reaction when you heard about the trip?
I was surprised. I was among those who had no information in advance about it. But in retrospect, I'm not surprised. Seth Moulton and Peter, I didn't know Peter less well, but I've known Seth for 20 years. I got to know him when he was a Harvard undergraduate and through Peter Gomes, who was a pastor at Harvard Memorial Church, and Seth was very involved in that church. And I was served as a mentor to him when he left the university, graduated, and he joined up in the Marine Corps. I was surprised. Not many people from Harvard joined the Marine Corps voluntarily. But he did that. And I think it's worth understanding, Desiane, just in terms of context.
So I think we've lost David. I think that bell tone makes it pretty clear that we have lost David. So while we try to get him back, I'm going to give a little bit more context for the listener here while we try to get David back. He said that he was surprised by the move, but after thinking more, not so surprised. The White House was surprised. It's one of the things that we will ask David about. In fact, Congressman Moulton and Congressman Meyer did not tell the president, did not tell the White House, did not inform the State Department and the military that we know of the trip prior to arriving there. And that has actually been part of the controversy of this move. And it's particularly surprising given the all-Democratic congressional delegation here in Massachusetts and what has appeared to be a fairly unified and strong relationship with the Biden administration, which, of course, is also a Democratic administration. Now, Moulton has been critical of President Biden throughout this withdrawal process. He's been very clear about that. There have been articles written about it extensively just in the last 2 or 3 days. But it's a little bit surprising to catch the White House by surprise on a visit of this magnitude, especially during an evacuation. David, do we have you back?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. I don't know where I left you. Was I in mid-paragraph?
Seth Moulton had just left church at Harvard University and gone to the Marines.
Okay. On the Marines. He signed up for the Marine Corps, served 3 tours, parents really, really anxious, didn't like the war. He discovered he didn't like the war either. But he left after 3 tours. He'd done enough. He'd met all his requirements. And he was going to come back to graduate school at Harvard, the Kennedy School and the Business School, when he got a call from General Petraeus, who said, the president has just called me and he wants me to go back to Iraq with a surge, see if we can win this thing. Can you join me? And Seth, you know, it was a difficult decision because he'd already had 3 tours. His parents didn't want him to go, but he said yes. And he went back, and he didn't serve in the Green Zone. He was in some really tough situations there. And his interpreter became extraordinarily important to him. They even developed a radio show in Baghdad called Seth and Muhammad, and people could call in. So when Seth left Iraq, he made great efforts to secure passage for his interpreter to move to the United States. And that's worked out very happily. They've been very good friends for a long time. So I think it's important to understand at least that context. And as I say, in ordinary times, I think you would say it was inappropriate to do what he and Peter Maggiore did.
Okay,
Peter
is
also very outstanding.
Let me jump in on a couple of things there, David. And I want to note, you said before the break that you were a mentor. It's clear that you two were close. You did say that under normal circumstances, this would be surprising.
Yes.
It's not normal circumstances. Is it in any way upsetting? There are concerns that this distracted people and precious resources, despite the fact that the congressmen both said they tried not to do that, from a massive relocation effort or evacuation effort.
Look, we've had 6,000 troops there who are very focused. I really don't think that these two congressmen coming through has changed anything. Yeah, it rather has given, I think, Bolton and I think Peter Maggiore both had a chance to look around on the ground, and sort of it did fortify their beliefs that we ought to extend, that it would be a serious mistake not to extend this deadline. We're going to leave a lot of people behind, and Seth believes very strongly, as do every other veteran I've ever talked to about this, believes very strongly we should not leave people behind. It's a matter of honor. It's a matter of moral commitment. And we shouldn't do it. We should, and that's what our allies have been telling us. When the president had the G7 call yesterday, the allies were saying, Mr. President, you ought to extend a little while longer, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. It's not very many numbers, but it's going to make a very big difference in how many people get left behind.
So I'm going to come back to how you would advise the president right now, but I'm going to stay on this for a minute longer. Because what's playing in the back of my head as I'm listening to you is, you know those charts where they talk about incidents that can be low probability but very high catastrophe if they happen. Given that you said this doesn't necessarily change a lot, there must have been at least some small amount of risk that the Taliban could, that ISIS could have attacked, or that the Taliban could have captured Moulton. Would it have been worth the risk? I mean, that could have significantly derailed the evacuation.
I think that's a legitimate concern. But it's worth remembering where he was. He was in the middle of the airport. That's where you even have 6,000 people there, so that people won't get hurt. There's been no American fatality and no American injury during this time. It's one of the good news pieces of what we've been doing, because nobody's gotten hurt. It's the very reason why our allies in Europe say it's not that dangerous. If we do this right, we can get it done, and we won't leave people behind. But once you leave them stranded, you're at the mercy of the Taliban, and who knows what will come with that. But it's scary. It's frightening. It's been a huge. I mean, we've started treating this like a victory lap because we have something. It's a compared to the Berlin aircraft, and when we had an airlift in Berlin, which was really, really successful. This is extremely well done by the military, but it comes out of an effort that is almost universally seen as a botched withdrawal.
Do you think it was botched, David?
I think there were several things about it, but it didn't work out. I mean, nobody would have intentionally done what we've seen unfold. You higher ups would not allow that. I do think there's a bit of a tension here between the military and some of the stewards of the administration. I happen to think this, Biden administration got off to a great start. It's been bumpy recently, but it got off to a great start, and they have very impressive people for their domestic side of the house. And in fact, I think Jake Sullivan and people on the international security side are very, very good. But you've got in this situation, other than the Secretary of Defense, there's no one in the top leadership who has served in the military, to best of my knowledge.
David,
and go ahead.
To follow up to that, I'm partly bringing it back home here as well. You just talked about the fact that there are a few people who served in the military. We've been talking about Congressman Moulton, who served as a Marine in Iraq. We've also been hearing from the congressman here in Massachusetts, Jake Auchincloss, also a Marine who served in Afghanistan. They have been on this is interesting. Both Democrats, both fairly young men who served their country in regional conflicts. They seem to have different views of the level of competence and appropriateness of the Biden administration's actions here. When people with shared experience like that don't see this the same way, they represent the same Commonwealth, and people here in the Commonwealth are trying to sort this out for themselves. How does one decide what's right and wrong here, what's going well and isn't?
I think it's really important to let events play out a little bit before making final judgments on how well handled or they were or they weren't. I don't know Jake Auchincloss very well, but I have a great deal of respect for the way he ran for Congress and the way he's conducted himself since he got there. But I think it's quite possible that both views that there's an element of truth to both. Surely there's an element. I happen to think that Biden did the right thing by withdrawing, and we should have done it a long time ago. So I give him credit for that. But the people who are veterans and others who are saying, but we botched it by the way we did it, I think there's truth to that as well. I mean, those are not inconsistent statements.
So, David, I'm mindful in preparing for today, producer Chris Siddick and I were looking at a report from The Washington Post that looked at lessons learned from 20 years in Afghanistan. It is damning. It talks about everything from failed strategies to confusing metrics to a lot of lying from multiple administrations.
Yes, I agree. That was what was startling to me, too. I thought we'd gotten past that stage, the country, frankly.
So now we're here. And in this last minute or so, with your wisdom, where can we take a moment of optimism, or where is there an opportunity to come out of this with something that takes us a step forward in the world and takes our allies forward?
I think one of the important things we can do now is to open our arms and welcome these Afghan refugees who've gotten out, to make sure that they come back to a place where they're treated with great respect, and as if it's going to be a new home for them. I've been part of conversations over the last 2 weeks with people who were trying to figure out what can be done, and I think there are some promising initiatives that will unroll over the next few weeks to show that we are really, as a nation, we have a large heart for the people who've gone through such trauma, and we should recognize that we've been part of their journey. And we shouldn't be afraid of admitting that. I think there's much we can say positive about the American response, but there's also much the world looks at and sort of laughing at us and sort of saying, you know, the Russians and the Chinese are having a field day on this.
David, we're going to end there. That's David Gergen, former White House advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, and the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. Appreciate you putting up with our technical difficulties. I really appreciate you joining us.
No, it was great. It was always good to be with you, Tiziana. Take care.
Thanks, David. You too. At the beginning of August, we caught you up on more than 700 nurses at St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester who had been on strike since March 8th. And as of today, they are still not back at work. Tenet Healthcare, which owns St. Vincent, made a final contract offer earlier this month, which the nurses tentatively accepted. But Tenet's offer doesn't include returning the nurses to their pre-strike positions. While all would be rehired, roughly 100 would have to go to other jobs as Tenet hired replacements for them during the dispute. That is a deal breaker for the striking nurses, and so the walkout continues. With the pandemic continuing to rage, time is of the essence for everyone. So we want to dig into this one. Today we're talking with the nurses and with a labor expert. Tomorrow we will hear from St. Vincent Hospital and a reporter who's been covering the whole thing. So joining us now, Marie Ritacco. She is a nurse in the post-anesthesia care unit at St. Vincent Hospital. She's also a member of the Nurses Contract Negotiating Committee and vice president of the Massachusetts Nurses Association, which is the union representing the striking nurses here. Marie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So, Marie, we have 700 nurses not engaged in patient care during a 100-year pandemic, and it's been almost 6 months. How did we get here?
Well, we got here because the nurses of St. Vincent Hospital, after many months of trying to convince the hospital prior to the pandemic that we were in a healthcare crisis inside the building because of lack of bedside staffing, mostly nurses. And once the pandemic hit, as our conditions got exponentially worse and communication broke down between the nurses and the hospital, we knew that we had no choice but to take this fight to the streets. We certainly gave due diligence to trying to fix this within the building. We spent many months, as I said, prior to and after the pandemic began, to convince them that we needed additional staffing. The conditions in that hospital had deteriorated. Honestly, I have to tell you, since Carolyn Jackson came to St. Vincent Hospital about 2.5 years ago, not only did conditions at the during labor management deteriorate, but conditions at the bedside did. Our patients were suffering. They were waiting far too long to have their call lights answered. Patients were falling at an alarmingly high rate. Patients were developing bed sores, were crying for pain medicine, and we just weren't able to do justice to, you know, the patients that we were caring for.
So just for listeners, Carolyn Jackson is the CEO of St. Vincent Hospital. I hear you, and I understand. I asked you how we got here, and you laid out the case for the strike. I also want to ask, so then 6 months not in the hospital providing patient care during the pandemic, how does that sit with you? To be out of the patient care game. You said there was a crisis in that hospital before you guys took to the streets. Have you worried about what's happening in that hospital when you're not in there?
Of course, we are very concerned about that. You know, last week we accepted their final offer, including their staffing proposal. We knew at that point, with the numbers climbing with COVID, you know, fueled by the Delta variant, that we had come to the point where we achieved enough to make us feel that we made a difference, that conditions will be safer once our contract is implemented, but we knew it was imperative that we get back into that hospital as soon as possible. So just simply put, they are holding us out here at this point out of retaliation. That is just so wrong-minded.
So when you accepted the contract, Marie, did you know about this portion that said we will not rehire you back to your original jobs? Some 100 of you will have to go to other jobs?
Well, I think our assumption was that it would be like it was the last time we went on strike. At the end, we put our proposal for return to work and that it would be accepted, which is every nurse goes back to their own position. However, the hospital gave us their proposal, and it was vastly different from what we consider safe. And I'll tell you why. I'll give you an example. We have a level 2B nursery. The hospital likes to tout that they provide advanced practice abilities by our registered nurses that work there to take care of infants that are born 32 weeks and forward. So these are very fragile patients. And we have the hospital proposing to us that in a return to work, two nurses on the day shift who each have 40 years experience would be displaced and replaced by two nurses that are novices who don't have the expertise or the skill. That is not good for our community.
So do you think this is going to work, Marie? Staying out now, do you believe this will work? Or I guess I'm wondering, not having been engaged in a strike myself, if there isn't a risk the hospital will hire more nurses to replace the ones who are not in the building. Are you worried that this is a game of chicken you might lose?
You know, it is incumbent upon Tenet to not only answer to the nurses, but they have to answer to our community. You know, we have tonight seven faith leaders from different congregations coming to the line to show their support for our cause because they know this is a just cause. We have nearly every congressional leader, every legislator, the mayor, the city council supporting our position, all of whom want us back in that building to care for our community, particularly now as the Delta variant continues to impact the entire city and our sister hospitals. No one's speaking out for Tenet or holding rallies for them. You can be assured of that. Plus, we have other organizations and unions all across the country who are supporting this cause. And yes, we want to be back in that building as soon as possible, but we need to do it, and we need to send the message to Tenet. They have to realize it's time to work with us and not continue to abuse us to get us back into that building.
All right. So just a note again to listeners that we will have someone from St. Vincent Hospital, which is owned by Tenet, on tomorrow. Marie, before I let you go, When you're back, what are you most looking forward to doing in your workday? What do you miss the most?
Just, you know, caring for people, the hands-on care, you know, bringing comfort, helping to heal people. It's what we live for, you know. And I know that if tenants would come to their senses, they would realize that what we're proposing is what is best for the community, to have the experienced nurses back at the bedside, for us to be able to help to mentor and orient the newer nurses that are going to be coming into this facility. You know, we realize that we need new hires, of course, because we had over 100 nurses leave St. Vincent Hospital even before we went out on strike. So there certainly is room for these nurses that were hired during our strike. But we need to get those very experienced expert hands back into the areas that they came from. It's imperative for the health of our community.
All right. That is Marie Ritacco. She's a nurse in the post-anesthesia care unit at St. Vincent Hospital, a member of the Nurse Contract Negotiating Committee, and vice president of the Massachusetts Nurses Association. Marie, thank you.
Thank you.
And tomorrow, Carolyn Jackson, CEO of St. Vincent Hospital, will join us for a conversation on the last 6 months. So now we want to step back for some perspective on the strike. And to do that, we have Steve Striffler, who is the director of the Labor Resource Center at UMass Boston. Steve, thanks for joining us. Steve, do we have you there?
Yes, you do.
Hi, thanks for joining us. Steve, let me just start by asking you your reaction to what you heard from Marie.
She's a tough act to follow. It would be my first reaction. I think, you know, she sort of pinpoints it. I mean, I think in some ways what's going on at Tenet and St. Vincent, with Tenet and St. Vincent is, and the strike is kind of a microcosm of a larger problem that's going on throughout the healthcare industry, you know, that we see throughout the country, on a number of levels. But I mean, I think she was right on point.
So I want to ask you, Steve, is there, for people watching from the outside, I'll run a couple of the numbers that I ran when I was talking to Marie. You've got 700 nurses not involved in patient care during a 100-year pandemic. The strike's been going on for almost 6 months. We know that as of right now, that's the second longest nurses' strike in Massachusetts history. If it goes another week, it will become the longest. How is it shocking to see something like this, or is this par for the course in labor negotiations? And while you're at it, should anything or is anything traditionally different when we're in the kind of life and death situation that we're facing collectively right now?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think on some level, it's of course kind of outrageous because we're in the middle of a pandemic and this just shouldn't be happening. On the other hand, I mean, I do think it's part of kind of a broader trend within the industry, and that is, you know, 10 to 15 years ago, or within the last decade, more or less, we've really seen an industry, well, essentially an industry that has been taken over much more by private equity and big business during the last decade. So hospital operators, now owned really by some of the largest companies in the world, have been insufficiently staffing hospitals for quite some time. And so and it's also why we've seen the increase of strikes by nurses, because they've seen this firsthand and they've been telling us this since before the pandemic. But I mean, I think the pandemic in many ways has brought it, you know, to a head. And so Tenet Healthcare is not local. I mean, I think they own more than 60 hospitals, hundreds of healthcare facilities. It's a Fortune 500 company. And so they're operating kind of on a different logic. And I think the core of it, as Marie was talking about, is understaffing, and this has been chronic. It's brought to a head by, you know, certainly by the pandemic. But I mean, I think the question is, at least for me, is you know, why the understaffing? That is, we had nurses who selflessly sort of swarmed to hospitals during the beginning of the pandemic, threw themselves at the work, saved lives. You know, but why are they so exhausted that they're changing professions, retiring completely, leaving hospitals, or in this case, going on strike to change things? And I mean, I think the answer is complex, but it's really that hospital-based nursing jobs, as they're currently constructed, are essentially destroying the very people that hold them. They're unsustainable in the sense, not simply like in the sense that they don't pay sufficiently or are dangerous, and sometimes they are, sometimes they don't pay sufficiently, sometimes they are dangerous, and these problems should be addressed. But they're unsustainable simply in the sense of hospitals not being sufficiently staffed, which burns out nurses, essentially forces them either to leave or go on strike. So, and we've seen this we've seen this as the healthcare industry has been sort of controlled much more by private equity and large business.
Okay, so Steve, you have just painted a bleak picture. And I asked Marie, are you worried this won't work? You've just painted a picture that suggests that there are industry forces so much bigger that this won't work. What would it take to get healthcare staffing and nurses staffing, in your mind, back to, you know, are there labor negotiations? Is it some other industry change? Is it a financial change in who owns hospitals?
Yeah, I mean, maybe all of the above. I mean, I would say the first answer, like in an immediate sense in this case, is that we need to be listening to nurses. They've been telling us this for years. This is not just sort of a product of the pandemic, and they've been making this call about understaffing for a long time. I think we need to learn more about, yes, I mean, I think what you're pointing to is who's in control of these. We've gone from hospitals that were much more state-owned or owned by nonprofits like religious communities that used to own them to hospitals that are really hospital systems that are owned by some of the largest companies in the world. And that may require things. It may not be enough. I mean, I think in this case, the nurses have done a great job in getting community support, political support. Hopefully they can pressure Tenet Healthcare into, you know, I mean, really coming to the table here at the end. They have an agreement. They just need to kind of, the back to work thing is just ridiculous. But I think in a larger sense, we do need to have a larger discussion that would involve some sort of regulation of these companies and the way we sort of provide healthcare and who's sort of in control of it, because it's not working. And we've seen this just in a larger sense, right, of hospitals owned by private equity. In particular, we see cuts to staff, particularly around the pandemic, which is just astounding to many of us. I think Tenet Healthcare immediately within the first month of the pandemic cut their own labor force by about 10%, which is just counterintuitive, I think, to most of us. So, yeah, I mean, I think there does need to be a deeper look into this.
All right. That is Steve Striffler. He's the director of the Labor Resource Center at UMass Boston. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Emma LaVecchia spends her day overseeing 10 preschools around Greater Boston. And sometimes that means putting on a mask and grabbing crayons or craft paper or glue or doing whatever it takes to help out her teachers, because LaVecchia's Pine Village preschools are understaffed, like so many other childcare centers across Massachusetts and across the country. The childcare industry has been hit especially hard by this pandemic. We talked to Emma and to Amy O'Leary of Strategies for Children last May when childcare centers were preparing to reopen. Now, with more people, including some of us at WBUR, preparing to return to work in person, will the industry be there? We've brought Emma and Amy back to talk about it, and we want to hear from you. Are you getting ready to go back to work in person? Have you recently done so? Are you having problems finding childcare? Are you worried about health and safety? Have you found a childcare that is delighting you? Maybe you're a childcare provider yourself. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Emma, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Amy, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So, Emma, what did it feel like to hear me tell everybody that you're trying to run 10 childcare centers and you're cutting and pasting and maybe getting glitter on your clothes in the classroom at the same time?
Those are the best of times. That's why we do this, you know? So I need to also say that I am not the only person who's running 10 schools. We have an incredible admin team who also has been completely hands-on, boots in the ground in the schools, doing whatever's needed. But, you know, I think being forced is the wrong word, but having to be back in the schools has actually been a blessing. It's really brought us all tighter. There's greater understanding of all of the struggles and the challenges that directors and teachers face every day. It's just part of what's happening right now.
Amy, what we just heard from Emma, is that what you're hearing from other providers?
Absolutely. And while, yes, as directors, we often have roots as teachers, and it's important to go back, Emma's also trying to do many other jobs at the same time. And we're hearing this from across the state. It's not just one area. Directors are in the classrooms 8 to 4, which means, or 7:30 to 5:30, which means they're not doing the other parts of their job, which could include intake for September, you know, thinking about professional development for educators and just finding educators. We have heard story after story of the crisis, which I know we've been talking about for many years, decades. I feel like it's really going to come to a head in the next few months because we are seeing well-funded, well-supported programs having to close classrooms.
So listeners, what are your childcare stories right now? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. Emma, Amy, there are so many questions I want to ask you, but as I just hear this part of it from the two of you, I find myself wondering, how are the kids? Emma.
So the kids, I feel like, are so incredibly resilient. And we, I'm so grateful to be able to give them what they need, which is consistent, loving, joyous care. And we have had a core group of teachers who were with us before the pandemic and came back when we were able to open back in August of 2020. It's hard for me to even keep track of the years. And, you know, those teachers have really held our school communities together. And those parents and the kids are so connected with our staff. I think, you know, just knowing that they can come every day and see the same faces and have that consistency and feel that love and see their friends again, that feels good to be able to give them. And so, I think they're okay.
I'm glad to hear that.
But one more thing. We are seeing this whole new kind of wave of kids who are coming in, the quote pandemic kids who were born during this time or maybe hadn't started school, were under 15 months. And they've spent the last year and a half at home really isolated and not having social experiences. And they're coming into preschool now with not necessarily challenges, but a whole different social experience. And, you know, we are having to sort of retrain staff and help them understand what these kids need now.
So what do you do differently for these kids, Emma? How does the day or the play that you choose or the activities that you choose, any of it, differ given this new generation of little ones coming in?
Yeah. I kind of feel like we have to wrap them in bubble wrap, you know? Like, I think their transition into school, like the first several weeks, is going to take a little bit longer than traditionally. I think that it's good to have them maybe in smaller classrooms with fewer kids to be able to manage a class so that maybe, you know, we have two or three kids working in a little pod instead of having all of them together. I think just being able to kind of ease them back in to a group setting with, you know, not crazy stimulation will help them.
I want
to kind of transition.
I want to ask listeners, do you feel like your little one's going to need to be wrapped in bubble wrap in the first few weeks of school of childcare if they go? What are you expecting from that experience? What are you worried about from that experience? What are you hoping for if you're preparing to return your child to childcare or to go to childcare for the first time? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy, I'm mindful as we're having this whole conversation, I mean, a huge piece of this just has to do with staffing and staffing shortages. And that's particularly interesting given that just before the break, and I don't know if you heard this, but we were having a conversation about a nursing strike, right? Nurses strike, where the issue was understaffing in the hospital. People know there are staffing shortages in childcare centers, but there's a lot behind why, and that's probably not easy to understand if you don't run childcare centers. So why are we seeing such a staffing shortage?
That's right. And I think I just want to reiterate what Emma said, and we use words like innovation, flexibility, creativity, sometimes to describe the tech industry. But when you think about the heroic efforts of educators and directors who have really been keeping it going, and we've been using the kind of the tagline of, you know, childcare is keeping the economy going. Well, now is our chance to really pay up on what we've been talking about. So as you said, it's complex, right? Our funding model was not working before COVID. It's not working. It's you know, not going to work in the future. And especially around the workforce, we have programs competing with other industries who can offer $17, $19 an hour, you know, providing higher education opportunities. So part of it is the public dollars that have been you know, previously available in the system have never been enough to cover the true cost of care. And then what we learned during the pandemic was most of the children are funded by parents' fees. And, you know, the answer cannot be that parents have to pay more in a state that we run number one or number two for child care. And so it's really looking about this flexible business model. The Baker administration released a future of work report. And one of the second recommendation was about hybrid work and the demand for flexible child care options, really thinking about how this business model can evolve. And so, that is going to be, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish that thought, Amy, and then I'm going to go to a call.
It's going to be trickier to do that than just kind of like changing the Excel spreadsheets we use. Because if our funding model has been based on full enrollment, you know, children's attendance, and we are really going to shift that. If families are looking for partial day or 3 days a week, it's really going to upset the market, which was so tenuous to start with.
So I'm just going to feed this back to you, and then I'm going to go to a call, but I want to make sure I'm understanding this. So basically, the staffing model is predicated on a full childcare center on regular, predictable hours with all that money regularly coming in. And now it's just not going to be like that anymore. And the business model has not caught up with that. Plus, we underpay, and finding new sources of revenue to pay teachers is just a pernicious lasting challenge. Is that a fair summary of what you said?
That's an excellent summary. And what I would also add is it's also parents' personal decisions as they're maybe thinking about September and maybe changing their mind. Those personal decisions, maybe not to send the child, are going to have these implementation and policy impacts that are not going to happen maybe on the same day, but, you know, are going to impact the financial bottom line for these programs.
All right. That's helpful. Thank you, Amy. I want to go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. Donna's calling in Acton. Donna, I think you're calling about a child care worker, right?
Yes. My daughter, Ruthie, works for child care. She worked in the MGH system throughout the pandemic. She's tireless and dedicated to these children. They have just transitioned to Bright Horizons, and the management has been very supportive and wonderful throughout the pandemic. But the bottom line is they're just not paying her enough. She has to work in a restaurant on nights and weekends just in order to make a living wage. And it's just so sad. She loves the children. She loves her job. She went to college for this. She's got a bachelor's degree from Lesley. This is what she wants to do, but I just wish they could pay her more money.
Donna, thank you for that very pointed story. So, Emma, does that resonate?
Absolutely. I mean, our experience this year has been that wages have increased by about 15%. So,
hired? Maybe, okay.
Yeah, hired. Right, hired pre-pandemic. You know, I would say with a bachelor's, like this woman's daughter, for example, and a degree in early childhood, probably would have been hired around $19, $20 an hour. Now they're getting $25 an hour, $27 an hour. So, you know, there is a huge increase in demand for teachers and they should be paid that kind of money. They should be making a living wage, you know. It's very difficult, as you and Amy both described. The model has not caught up to that demand yet.
If you could pick one thing to change right now, like if I could just free up my model by doing X, what would be the most effective single change you could make right now, Emma?
Oh, I don't know that there's one change. I mean, I would love to take the perception of early childhood educators and raise that to a higher level so that we could acknowledge our staff the way they deserve to be acknowledged, with salaries that are living wage. And, you know, I don't think that parents are going to be able to absorb all of that cost. I'm not sure what the solution is for that. Our mission here has always been around career development and assuring that teachers understand and feel like they are professionals and that this is their career.
Let's go back to the phones here. We've got more callers in. Emma, thank you. So we've got 800-423-8255. We've got Eden on the line in Manchester by the Sea. Eden, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Dr. Eden Davies. I'm a child and family psychologist up on the North Shore, and I have three little girls aged 2, 4, and 5. And so we're all going to be reentering the school system. My little one, yeah, grew up during this COVID time, so she hasn't had that sort of experience. So I was just, I don't know, I thought I would chime in about some of the things that we've been doing over the summer to sort of prepare them for that transition.
Tell me one in particular, Eden.
Yeah, getting them used to new caregivers. We've tried, you know, hiring a lot of different babysitters, you know, just like, you know, an hour here, 2 hours there, short time frames, just so that, like, they can get used to being with new people instead of, you know, just our family.
Eden, thank you for that. And thank you for reminding us that there can be some intentionality, Amy, to preparing a child to go into early education and care. Are there advice that you would give parents, Amy?
You know, listening to you earlier this week about thinking this is the third year of the COVID impact on education really hit me, because I think as we're doing this, we're not calculating that in our heads, especially around early education, because that's the lifespan of some of the children we're talking about. So I think that's exactly right. Getting to know, connecting with the providers, but also kind of keeping this assume positive intent mentality. You know, we've seen, you know, the photos of the whole world is short staffed. Be kind. I think also what Emma brought up is how careful this transition needs to be. In September with transitions, everyone's learning new rules. There's separation anxiety. So parents kind of keeping it together and making sure they are also talking to their children about that we're going to a safe place, that I'm going to know what's going on in the classroom, and I'm going to be checking in. And just one more thing to think about, the first week may go great and you may breathe a sigh of relief, but then week 3 may be a challenge. So just managing all of our expectations and taking stock and taking the time for those smooth transitions.
I feel like people should take a note on that week 3 thing, having had a couple of children go through early education and care. So flagging that one for you listeners. I'd like to go back to the phones here. We've got Kathy on the line in Somerville. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. I have been a nanny, or I've worked in child care for 13 years. I'm actually calling from the parking lot. I just dropped off my Section 8 application, and I just wanted to say that I've never, in my years of working in child care, I've never been able to make enough money to provide for myself and my own son. The last daycare that I worked at, despite all my years of experience and having a bachelor's degree in child development, I was only making $17 an hour, which put me just enough over the poverty line that I didn't qualify for food stamps or state health insurance. But I wasn't even making enough money to rent one bedroom in an apartment for my son and myself to share, let alone, you know, affording health insurance for myself or being able to buy food to eat.
Kathy, for our listeners who don't know, Section 8 is an affordable housing application. You said you're in the parking lot. You just filled out your application. How are you? You okay?
Yeah, you know, I'm okay. Yeah.
All right. Listen, we'll be thinking about you. Thank you for calling. And we'll think about your son, too.
Suzanne, if I can just pick up on that, there one of the opportunities we see right now is prioritizing early educators to access a subsidy so that they can go back to work and that their children can have care. This is something we have heard over and over in the past 2 weeks. I could open up another classroom if this one teacher could get some support in providing childcare. So we can have a whole other conversation about how early educators are eligible for public assistance. A study has showed in Massachusetts 37% of early educators are for some kind of public assistance. But we think this could be one solution for this immediate crisis to support educators who are doing the work every day.
So just to clarify for listeners, that was Emma speaking, right? Emma.
It was Amy.
Oh, Amy.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. See, I'm glad we clarified because I got
Me
confused.
Too.
I was talking. So Amy, what is one step people can take if they are interested in trying to avail themselves, child care providers, if they're trying to avail themselves of those resources?
I think we are looking to think about a state policy change, but I would say to tell your story. And I think Kathy, for calling from the parking lot. You know, sometimes we don't talk about real numbers because, you know, it can seem like, well, I can't believe I'm not eligible for this or that. So just using real numbers, understanding the cost of living, because we've been talking about low pay, but really making that real to people, I think, is so incredibly powerful. And at Strategies for Children, we're happy to help to support people, to provide testimony, to connect with your state legislators, any help we can provide to promote and highlight your stories.
Thank you for that, Amy. So, Emma, now I'm going to turn back to you. And I think I want to ask you, Emma, at the very beginning of this conversation, we talked about the fact that you have a big set of administrative responsibilities in addition to helping out in the classroom because you're short-staffed. How are you doing after 16 months of this, after your child care centers? You know, we talked last May. How are you putting one foot in front of the other, and can you keep going and get through this next wave?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we're all okay. We keep saying we're working harder than we've ever worked before, but we've been through tough times and we will get through this. And, you know, we've had to make some really tough decisions and we might have to make more tough decisions. And I think one thing that we learned in this last year and a half is around communication with our families, communication with our staff, communication amongst ourselves here, that if we can keep talking and keep being real and open and, talking about our challenges, but also talking about planning and, you know, the reality of things and how can we help and, talking about our policies with families and the way things need to be, that has kept us healthy. And, you know, we've gone through serious financial challenges this last year and, I think we'll be okay. We're still here. So it's just incredible. And I think maybe when it's all over and we look back, we'll all fall apart. But right now, you know, we're in it and we're just doing, everybody's doing what they have to do. Everybody.
Amy, just in a sentence, this is a time where it can be of great adventure for children. What's one thing that could be fantastic for kids in childcare this year?
I think one, for other adults to recognize what other adults are doing for children and families. And I think it's providing these safe spaces with high quality early education and care to bring back some of that joy of learning and really the wonder that's going to keep us going throughout this pandemic.
Oh, thanks. Amy O'Leary, director of the Early Education for All campaign at Strategies for Children, and Emma LaVecchia, co-founder of Pine Village Preschool. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. We had help from Ali Audette and Stephen Gelman. And today was Stephen's last day with us, and we wish him good luck and Godspeed. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.